This made me wonder how long after the event the Air Ministry officials arrived at King Harold's Way, to take statements from any people still standing on the pavement, Margaret Fry ponders. Of course, the Air Ministry officials would not have knocked on people's doors, thereby adding to the significance of the event, which as always officialdom once kept secret. 12. Following the incident, Margaret had an attack of paralysis affecting her lower limbs. I could not move and was very frightened, she recalls. My sister came home from work about 6 p.m., fed the children, and sent for our GP, Dr. Lobo, who thought I had polio. These symptoms lasted only a short while and I recovered. Had being in close proximity to an alien craft had an adverse effect? Dr. Thew Carter, the young Indian doctor who together with Margaret and her son witnessed the landing, died young of a brain tumor a few years later. 13. Some years later, when I decided to investigate this, our own astonishing sighting, my GP, Dr. Lobo, told me that Dr. Thew Carter had reported the incident to the British Medical Board. How much notice did they take? I wonder. They did not bother to interview me nor those children. I have in fact tried to contact them over the years, periodically, without success, as I no longer live in North Kent. 14. I calculate that, with the 90 residents of King Harold's Way, plus the 30 teenagers, then the 10 or 12 children on Ashbourne Avenue plus Dr. Thew Carter, Steve, and myself, approximately 130 people had witnessed these amazing events, Margaret told me. This estimate may be unreliable, bearing in mind that so many could not be traced, or chose not to come forward. Nonetheless, numerous witnesses were present at these events. Close encounters with landed craft reported by large groups are rare. The Bexley Heath incidents, for me, are the most convincing. And yet, apart from the report in a local newspaper, why did such a momentous story not appear in the national press? In 1955, Margaret explains, we were not a publicity-conscious nation of people. I do not suppose that it occurred to any one of those people to contact a national newspaper. In addition, the remaining witnesses still on King Harold's Way when the Air Ministry officials had arrived must have been told not to talk about the incident. No doubt later they also informed their neighbors. 15. And why were no photographs taken? Cameras were not that common in 1955, and it is likely that those who possessed them did not have them to hand when the incidents occurred. In the unlikely event that any photos had been taken, it is also feasible that they would have been confiscated by the Air Ministry officials. How did Margaret feel in the ensuing weeks after her encounter? Well, firstly an elation that we are not alone in this vast, vast universe, she explains. I think almost every human being who has the ability to think must yearn to feel that at least some of the myriad upon myriad of stars we see in the night sky, which represent suns with perhaps planets revolving around them, such as in our solar system, are also teeming with life as we know it. So, I was elated. I felt as though I had my feet striding to worlds, wherever that other world may be. And the link had been that strange object. However, with these feelings of elation came loneliness. My son was too young to share these sentiments with, and it isolated me from the rest of my family. 16. Australia, the Bexley Heath event is not an isolated case. In 1966, for instance, several hundred Australian witnesses, including students, teachers, and residents in Clayton South, a Melbourne, Victoria, suburb, witnessed an astonishing series of events. The following synopsis is based on an article in an educational magazine by Tina Luton, who interviewed researcher Shane Ryan, an English lecturer at the University of Canberra who has spent 5 years investigating the case, interviewing hundreds of residents as well as former staff and pupils from three schools in the area to complete his documentary, Westall 66, A Suburban UFO Mystery, which aired on SBS television in late 2010. At about 10:15 on the morning of April 6, a group of Westall High School students were completing a sports session when a silvery-gray saucer-shaped craft, about twice the size of a family car, overflew the school and descended behind some trees on the Grange Reserve in front of Westall State School. One girl, Terry Beck, was playing cricket when the craft approached. She chased after it into the reserve. Two other girls were already on the scene. One was terribly upset, and they were pale, really ghostly white, Terry recalls. They said they had passed out. One was taken to hospital in an ambulance. Other staff and students, alerted by cries of astonishment, rushed outside to see what all the commotion was about. "There are flying saucers in the sky," said one boy as he came in and interrupted a year 8 science lesson. We all burst out laughing. But the teacher said, "Let's go and have a look," Joy Clark recollects. It took a minute or two to sink in what I was looking at. There were 3 of them, flying saucers like you see in comic books. Suzanne Savage, another pupil, was present with Joy and their teacher, Andrew Greenwood, as they observed the objects. One, seemingly larger than the others, disappeared behind some trees and then reappeared, hovering a while before banking on its side and disappearing in seconds. 17. At one point, 5 light aircraft, presumed to have come from Moorabbin Airport, arrived on the scene. They flew low, down toward the flying saucer, as if trying to get closer to it, Shane Ryan reports. And every time they seemed to edge toward the strange craft, it just flitted away, as if playing a game with them of cat and mouse. By this stage, about 300 of the high school's 485 students had amassed on and around the oval, many climbing the high wooden fence on the school's western boundary, and the wire fence at the foot of the huge high-tension electric power pylon that stood on the school's southwestern corner. 2 such pylons were located at either end of the boundaries of the school property. The flying saucer had lifted off and over these power lines as it ascended into the sky from the school and moved south toward the Grange Reserve. At the sight of the flying saucer disappearing behind the pine trees, a huge chunk of kids who had been watching did what they all knew to be clearly against school rules, and jumped the low wire fence that separated the school from the drainage ditch, and then ran toward the Grange. 18. The craft, apparently, had landed. Pauline Kelly, in year 9 at the time, currently the school's bursar, did not see the craft, but she and 2 friends saw where it had landed. There was a perfect circle burned into the grass, she confirms. Unlike Bexley Heath, the West Hall event made the front page of the local Dandenong Journal for 2 weeks running, as well as Channel 9 Evening News. But there were repercussions. The film canister from this coverage was recently found empty, Suzanne Savage reported. And following the incident, she also noted the presence of people in uniforms, including police. The next morning the principal, Mr. Frank Sambulb, called a special assembly and said he never wanted us to speak of it again, and that there was no such thing as flying saucers. Science teacher Andrew Greenwood and others, including students, were warned against speaking about the matter by officials who visited them either at their homes or in the principal's office. Jacqueline Argent, then in year 9, was one of the first students over the fence, looking for where the larger saucer had landed. The following day she was called into the principal's office and interrogated by 3 men. They had good quality suits and were well spoken. "I suppose you saw little green men?" they said. 19. Although a number of parents, such as those who viewed the circle in the grass, believed their offspring, others did not. To this day, says Shane Ryan, after 45 long years have passed, many are still hurt that their own parents and siblings refused to believe them, or at least were reluctant to. 20. Chapter 6. Tales from the Vienna Woods. In Alien Base, I cited at some length the remarkable encounter with aliens in the Vienna Woods in October 1962. Reported to me by Bobby, a Filipino pianist then studying at the Vienna Academy. Bobby had been guided to a certain area, where he noted a sudden strange, sinister stillness, as in the Mongutsi case. I looked up and saw the leaves and branches of the trees shaking, disturbed by the sudden rush of air coming from a strange object, he reported. I could hear the whistling sound the object made as it glided smoothly and nearer to where I stood. The craft landed on 3 legs about 100 feet from him. 3 humanoid occupants, with lean, strong-looking bodies, dressed in tight-fitting black-brown suits extending from their shoes to their head, alighted. around their faces, which appeared human. They wore a glass visor with two tube-like devices attached from under their chins to their back, ending in what looked like an oxygen tank. Someone said something that seemed like a question, but I couldn't understand a word, said Bobby. One of the group, presumed to be the leader, then pressed something on a small box he was carrying and a beam of red light fell upon Bobby's eyes, inducing a soothing effect. The box also acted in part as a translating device, since the leader asked Bobby a question in English, with a slight accent, similar to that of Germans. The device also was able to detect Bobby's eyeglasses, before he took them out of his pocket. Asked by the leader if he would like to be with them or visit their place, Bobby declined. There followed a lengthy discourse on the iniquities of mankind, and a number of dire warnings, such as the following: observe carefully the great mass of humanity killing each other through centuries of war and strife. There are thousands of good people on your planet, but the mean and selfish humanity outnumbers the good by millions and millions. Someday you will all be wiped out by your own greediness, and if a few good people live through that, then they will propagate and breed an unselfish humanity and no longer will there be continuous strife. There is a great and possible danger, too, that your humanity's intense desire to conquer, eventually seeking power and domination over the other planets, will mean only a complete massacre for Earthmen, because other planets will retaliate with terrifying power and force. This is our message. Transmit it and let humanity beware. 1. Assuming substance to this story, as I do, since Bobby was a friend at the time, one can only wonder at the apparent lack of discrimination shown by these extraterrestrials regarding their choice of contact. Though deeply affected by this encounter, and other related experiences which ensued, Bobby was reluctant to tell even a few people about it, much less humanity at large. And even if he had transmitted the message to all and sundry, would it have made the slightest difference? Bobby believed that most people who have had similar encounters suffer from depression and others equally, owing to the futility of proving their experiences to others. But at least the story was published. A reversal of roles. Joseph Wondacker must be the only person on this planet who claimed not only to have ridden a motorbike into a flying saucer but, in a refreshing reversal of roles, lectured its occupants on the iniquities of humankind. Born in Vienna in 1929, he became an active member of an anti-fascist sabotage group in 1944, until Austria's liberation from the Nazis the following year. A jeweler by trade, Wondacker's first sighting of an unknown flying craft occurred in 1954. The following is extracted from an account he wrote in 1975, 2 from my interview with him in Vienna, 3 and ensuing correspondence. Wondacker had bought a Fuchs FM40S 1.5 horsepower single-cylinder engine to attach to the left side of the rear wheel of his bicycle, the better to enjoy recreational trips in the forests surrounding Vienna. On a late summer night in 1954, he was riding his roadster on high ground near Hohe Forest in Vienna's 13th district, admiring a magnificent view of Vienna, when suddenly he noticed a cigar-shaped silver object hovering over the city, moving from north to south. Its metallic, shining outer skin was so bright that I thought it was reflecting an anti-aircraft defense searchlight, which I recalled from wartime. But I could see no sign of any such searchlight. The distance between me and the craft must have been at least 5 miles, which made it seem the size of a medium-sized modern airliner, moving at about the speed of a sports plane. Wondacker dumped his roadster in a ditch and dashed to a nearby field that afforded a better view. There he encountered some Soviet army soldiers who had a base nearby. Part of Austria was under Soviet occupation at the time. They too had been observing the craft, and one joked that it might be a secret Soviet weapon. But Wondacker's definitive close encounter, in late August or early September of 1955, had a much greater impact. It was to change him forever. On this occasion, he was riding in woodland about 15 miles from the city, toward Arbeest. It was between 1400 hours and 1500 hours. Suddenly, I saw a dull metallic silver light shining through the shrubs. I rode toward the shrubs to find a gap where I could get through, and, when I did, I found myself in a glade. On the grass stood a metallic, disc-shaped object of about 2.5 meters height and 10 to 12 meters width, with a group of people in front of it, see photo section. I couldn't see any windows, portholes, or lights on its even and arched surface. Neither could I make out any wheels or undercarriage, but there was a ramp of about 4 meters in length and 2 meters width, extending from a roughly rectangular opening, with half-moon-shaped frames to each side of the opening. The distance between me and the disc was about 20 meters. I decided to enter the disc. "What on earth persuaded you to take such a daredevil risk?" I asked him, when we finally met in Vienna. At that time, I didn't care so much what would happen to me, he explained. I was tired of life, and also had private problems with my girlfriend. I wasn't even that concerned about dying. I already thought the disc was from another planet, and that perhaps they'd come to rescue me. His report continues. The inside of the disc-shaped object was illuminated by an indirect yellow light. It resembled the ideal illumination for an intimate living room atmosphere, which we tried to achieve today. The short, arched walls seemed to continue infinitely in the background. I could see neither levers, instrument boards nor panels, seats, or beds for the passengers. The inside of the disc was illuminated in an inviting way, giving me no reason to be afraid. I switched my engine off and freewheeled onto the ascending ramp and into the disc. When I stopped, I found myself in front of a group of five or six beings, about 1.80 meters tall, with unblemished, beautiful faces that one can only find with children between the age of 6 and 10. Their clothes consisted of overalls of a grayish color without any signs of seams, pockets, or any openings. The shoes were incorporated into this clothing and didn't show any outline of toes. The hands were covered with mitts, also incorporated in their overalls. Since these overalls were loosely covering their slim figures, I couldn't make out the sexes, for example contours of breasts. Their necks came out of a sort of silk frill. Their hair was mid-length and blonde, and they wore a close-fitting cap on the back of their heads. Remaining seated on his bike, Wondeker introduced himself, saying where he lived and apologizing for having intruded in such a fashion. The alien said they came from the highest part of the Cassiopeia constellation, from Earth's perspective. Asked how they could speak German, they replied simply that they'd learned it. Their voices were similar to those of female adult humans, with a high pitch. They pronounced the individual syllables similar to the accent of English people speaking German. Although I didn't know much about astronomy at that time, the distance between our Earth and Cassiopeia sounded enormous to me. However, it seemed more important to ask them what type of society they lived in. Wondeker, a committed and evidently fanatical socialist at the time, went on to explain Earth's various types of societies and the iniquities of mankind. As leading researcher Gordon Creighton noted wryly in his resume of the case, Herr Wondeker delivered a summary account of the conditions prevailing upon our planet, delivering himself of a splendid and heated left-wing harangue well larded with all the usual clichés, and directed primarily against inequalities and privileges. Maybe the visitors found this a trifle boring, for after a while their attention seemed to rivet onto the odor of warm oil coming from his little motor. 4. Oil was dripping out of the valve near the cylinder, which was also covered with an oily skin and now smelled owing to the heat, Wondeker's report continues. I changed the subject and explained how my little engine worked, which evidently met with great interest. During my explanation of the types of terrestrial societies, the crew appeared to be very open-minded and interested. They told me their system no longer had different classes and that they knew all about the old-fashioned social structure on Earth. This I took as an opportunity to point out the miseries, diseases, and famine which kill millions of people. The surprising reply by the crew was that I myself should lead some attempt to overcome these problems, that I would be the best to understand how to start such a reformation on Earth. I abruptly refused this idea, telling them about the huge number of government officials who only serve a privileged class instead of the whole nation. Wondaka told the extraterrestrials that they themselves should initiate a type of society on Earth in which everyone is equal, because, he assumed, interplanetary beings were not corrupted by the temptations of Earth and had an overwhelming technological advantage. Such was the strength of his passionate delivery that the crew apparently was moved to tears. I therefore decided it was time to leave the spaceship as informally as I had entered it about 20 minutes earlier. I briefly waved my hand and wished them a pleasant day, whereupon they bowed, in a Far Eastern style. I turned my roadster, upon which I had been sitting all the time, through 180 degrees, managing it as easily as if on a smooth icy surface, then rolled down the ramp and out onto the grass in front of the spaceship. Wondaka was puzzled by the ease with which he turned the bike. The pattern of the floor looked like a Belgian waffle, which normally has grooves, though I can't say there were any, he recalled for me. The only way I can explain my being able to turn around so easily, bearing in mind the weight of my bike, 30 kilograms, and myself, 80 kilograms, is that I was under the influence of the same energy which propelled the craft. This was the most impressive part of my encounter. I was rather disappointed with the rest, since I'd expected the crew to be more helpful. They didn't tell me how to overcome the social problems on Earth, and I didn't feel up to taking a leading part in a revolution. For this reason, I didn't even look back to see the craft taking off, but took the nearest way home. Also, I didn't want to be questioned by any possible witnesses. Wondaka told no one about his experience for many years. Inside the craft, the inside of the flying disc corresponded basically with its outer form, whereby the edge of the inner disc didn't seem to be as curved as the outside, which was probably due to a cavity. When I entered the object, I noticed thick half-moon-shaped corners on both sides of the entrance opening. The ceiling inside seemed to be highly arched at the top, like the outer surface. Because of this, the ceiling and walls gave the optical illusion of blending into each other. From my seated position, I was unable to see any instruments, they might have been covered by the crew standing in front of them. Due to the diffused illumination, I couldn't see anything to sit or lie on. It might have been that seats or beds were installed in the walls or floor, or that they were hovering inside the disc during flights. I reckoned that the propulsion and guidance instruments were located underneath the floor and between the gaps of the inside and outside walls. As far as I remember from the crew's explanation, they operate by manipulating gravity and anti-gravity. At that time, Wondaka didn't understand the meaning behind all the technical terms they gave him, but later worked out that they somehow shrank space and time. As he explained to me, they told me that a cyclotronic aggregate caused a rotating energy field which puts the whole craft into a self-gravitating field. This form of energy is known to us as gravity and anti-gravity energy. The direction of flight could be determined by an oscillating frequency. Due to the motive power, it was possible to overcome the distance of light years, which is beyond our terrestrial physical concept of time and space. In nuclear science on Earth, the cyclotronic aggregate creates heavy matter by making atomic particles heavier than their original weight so that they subsequently rotate. I asked Joseph Wondaka for his overall impression of the visitors. They had a childlike appearance, he replied, and I got the impression they didn't want to come too close to us. They see us perhaps as we see primitive savages. How do you feel now, more than 40 years after this extraordinary encounter? I inquired. It was a mental elation for me, and it led me to study technical terms, for example. The whole experience still lurks in my subconscious. It's always there, and it replaces for me what others call religion. Was he aware that some encounters with extraterrestrials had been less than benevolent? There's been a lot said about them being bad, he answered, but I don't see it that way, at least, not from my own experience. In any case, I don't think there's a civilization anywhere that's as bad as ours. I can hardly imagine them organizing a holocaust like the Nazis did. Chapter 7 Infiltration. According to Harold T. Wilkins, a preeminent British author and researcher at the time, an unnamed friend of his who served as a pilot in the U.S. Air Force, reported to Wilkins in the summer of 1953 that he had heard sensational rumors purporting that the chiefs of the U.S. Air Force had secret information that mysterious individuals in the U.S. were known to have had contacts with some of the entities on one type of flying saucer. These individuals were alleged to be meeting flying saucer entities in remote places, in regions of the U.S. that are still unmapped, had taken orders from them, and were going round in parts of the West and Middle West on some secret purpose connected with these mysterious objects. Nor, said my friend, did the U.S. Air Force believe that any foreign power was concerned in the matter. 1. Reports of flying saucer sightings in California's Mojave Desert were rife in early April 1954. In hopes of a sighting, Kyle Anderson, together with his family and some friends, set off for a camping trip near Desert Hot Springs. As the convoy of three cars neared a dirt road on their left, an uncontrollable unseen force started to turn Kyle's driving wheel. "I immediately thought that something had gone wrong with the steering mechanism," he reports. "And then a voice whispered in my ear, 'Turn here, drive 3 miles and stop.'" Had his wife Stella, sitting beside him, been responsible? She said not. "It seemed," he explained, "as if I had suddenly been bathed from head to foot in lukewarm water, and the voice had actually seemed to come from inside my head, neither in my right nor my left ear, but from somewhere inside my brain." At the end of the 3 mile drive, Kyle and Stella set up a tent, which they shared with their daughter Betty Ann and son Bobby. A stove was lit and a snack meal consumed. It was a beautiful starry night in the clear desert air. But alas, no flying saucers, so the group retired some time after midnight. Brothers-in-law Jim Stewart and Harold Spencer, and their respective wives Terry and Eleanor, bedded down in their cars. "How long I slept I do not know," said Kyle. "Suddenly I was wide awake and sitting upright." Stella and Betty Ann were also sitting up, but Bobby was still sleeping. As the three of us sat there wondering what had awakened us, a miracle happened. The tent slowly began to disappear until it became absolutely invisible and, looking out across the desert, apparently hovering a few inches off the ground, was a large shining disc. The diameter of this craft was about 60 feet. 5 windows, or portholes, were visible from where we were. The unearthly vehicle glowed all over with a dull fluorescent light, and a sort of halo seemed to surround the entire craft. I could not tell whether it had any landing gear. It appeared to hover about 18 or 20 inches off the ground. I tried to move toward this object. I wanted to go over and touch it, but I found that I could not move an inch. I was completely paralyzed. Stella and Betty Ann later said they had the very same experience. I did, however, manage to roll my eyes enough to glance at my wristwatch. The luminous dial read 3 o'clock, a.m. We did not know at the time just how long we remained in this paralyzed condition while we continued to watch and listen. We could now hear voices mumbling in a low tone, but could not tell, however, if the conversation was in English, as the sounds were very faint. After what seemed hours, we began to hear a slight humming sound like a generator running, a low droning, pulsating hum. The dim glow surrounding the saucer slowly took on an orange cast, then a bright red color. Then it started to rise straight up, very slowly at first, then faster and faster as it got higher and higher. The red light changed to a brilliant bluish white. Then slowly the tent began to reappear, and we were free to move about. We sprang to our feet and looked out through the tent flap. The brilliant blue-white light was streaking across the sky and soon disappeared over the horizon near Mount San Gorgonio. Betty Ann's first words were, "Daddy, where did the tent go? And why couldn't I move?" Harold and Delana had also been paralyzed and the car in which they were sleeping rendered invisible. But strangely enough, Jim and Terry, being further away in their car, had not even been awakened, and were dumbfounded when told of the saucer's visit. The next morning, said Cal, the clock in my car, which had been at some distance from the saucer, was 15 minutes faster than my wristwatch, indicating that it had stopped at 3 a.m. for a period of 15 minutes. The paralyzing rays had evidently stopped it. Since my watch is self-winding, It must have started again when the craft took off. In the late summer of 1955, while working at the U.S. Navy Yard near the No. 1 dry dock in Long Beach on an electrical installation, Carl suddenly felt suffused with a familiar warmth. A huge silvery disc appeared in the blue sky, observed also by his workmates.